second one in the fourth month. I made the mistake of telling her I once paid for an abortion, and she blamed me for losing the babies. She was right. The real cost of an abortion is much more than the lousy $300 at the clinic. I'm sorry. 10 years to the week after Screamer and I made our little road trip to Atlanta, my wife had the second miscarriage. A little boy. Neely, I really want to leave now. I'm sorry, he said. They sat on the front steps again. The lights were off. Mr. and Mrs. Lane were asleep. It was after 11. I think you should go now, Cameron said after a few minutes. You're right. You said earlier that you think about me all the time, Neely. I'm curious as to why. I had no idea how painful a broken heart can be until my wife packed up and left. It was a nightmare. For the first time, I realized what you'd suffered through. I realized how cruel I'd been. You'll get over it. Takes about 10 years. Thanks. He walked down the sidewalk, then turned around and walked back. How old is Jack? He asks. 37. Then, statistically, he should die first. Give me a call when he's gone. I'll be waiting. Sure you will, Neely. I swear. Isn't it comforting to know that someone will always be waiting for you? I really hadn't thought about it. He leaned down and looked her in the eyes. Can I kiss you on the cheek? No. There's something magical about the first love, Cameron. Something I'll miss forever. Goodbye, Neely. Can I say I love you? No. Goodbye, Neely. Friday. Messina mourned thoroughly and collectively. By 10 on Friday morning, the shops and cafes and offices around the square were locked. All students were dismissed from school. The courthouse was closed. The factories on the edges of town were shut down, a free holiday, though few felt like celebrating. Mal Brown placed his deputies around the high school, where by mid-morning the traffic was bumper to bumper on the road to Rakefield. By 11, the homestands were almost full, and the ex-players, the former heroes, were gathering and milling around the tent at the 50-yard line. Most of them wore their green game jerseys, a gift to every senior, and most jerseys were stretched tighter around the midsections. A few, the lawyers and doctors and bankers, wore sports coats over their game shirts, but the green was visible. From the bleachers up above, the fans looked down at the tent and the field and enjoyed the chance to identify their old heroes. Those with retired numbers caused the most excitement. There's Roman Armstead, number 81, played for the Packers. There's Neely, number 19. The senior class string quartet played under the tent, and the PA system lifted its sounds from end zone to end zone. The town kept coming. There would be no casket. Eddie Rake was already in the ground. Miss Lila and her family arrived without ceremony and spent a half hour hugging former players in front of the tent. Just before noon, the priest appeared, and then a choir, but the crowd was far from settled. When the home bleachers were full, they began lining the fence around the track. There was no hurry. This was a moment Messina would cherish and remember. Rake wanted his boys on the field, packed around the small podium near the edge of the tent. And he wanted them to wear their jerseys, a request that had been quietly spread in his last days. A tarp covered the track, and several hundred folding chairs had been arranged in a half moon. Around 12:30, Father McCabe gave the signal, and the players began packing into their seats. Miss Lyle and the family sat in the front rows. Neely was between Paul Curry and Silo Mooney, with 30 other members of the 1987 team around them. Two were dead, and six had disappeared. The rest couldn't make it. A bagpipe at the north goalpost began wailing, and the crowd became still. Silo was wiping tears almost immediately, and he was not alone. As the last melancholy notes drifted across the field, the mourners were softened up and ready for some serious emotion. Father McCabe slowly approached the makeshift podium and adjusted the microphone. "Good afternoon," he said in a high-pitched voice that broke sharply through the stadium speakers and could be heard half a mile away. "And welcome to our celebration of the life of Eddie Rake. On behalf of Mrs. Lila Rake, her 3 daughters, 8 grandchildren, and the rest of the family, I welcome you and say thank you for coming." He flipped a page of notes. "Carl Edward Rake was born 72 years ago in Gaithersburg, Maryland. 48 years ago, he married the former Lila Saunders. 44 years ago, he was hired by the Messina School Board as the head football coach. At the time, he was 28, had no coaching experience, and always said he got the job because no one else wanted it. He coached here for 34 years, won over 400 games, 13 state titles, and we know the rest of the numbers. More important, he touched the lives of all of us. Coach Rake died Wednesday night. He was buried this morning in a private ceremony, family only, and at his personal request, and with the consent of the Reardon family, he was laid to rest next to Scotty. Coach Rake told me last week that he was dreaming of Scotty, said he couldn't wait to see him up in heaven, to hold him and hug him and tell him he was sorry. With perfect timing, he paused to allow this to choke up the crowd. He opened a Bible. As he was about to speak, there was a commotion near the front gate. A loud radio squawked. Car doors slammed and there were voices. People were scrambling around. Father McCabe paused and looked, and this caused everyone else to look too. A giant of a man was walking briskly through the gate onto the track. It was Jesse Trapp, with a prison guard at each elbow. He was wearing perfectly pressed khaki pants and shirt, prison issue, and the handcuffs had been removed. His guards were in uniform and not much smaller. The crowd froze when they recognized him. As he walked along the sideline, his head was high, his back stiff, a proud man, but he also had a look of slight bewilderment. Where should he sit? Would he fit? Would he be welcome? As he approached the end of the stands, someone in the crowd caught his attention. A voice called out, and Jesse stopped cold. It was his mother, a tiny woman holding a place along the fence. He lunged for her and hugged her tightly over the chain link as the guards glanced at each other to make sure that, yes, it was okay for their prisoner to hug his mother. From a wrinkled grocery bag, Mrs. Trapp pulled out a green jersey, number 56, retired in 1985. Jesse held it and looked down the track at the former players, all straining to see him. In front of the same 10,000 people who once screamed for him to maim opposing players, he quickly unbuttoned his shirt and took it off. Suddenly, he exposed more brilliantly toned and tanned muscles than anyone had ever seen. And he seemed to pause so they and he could enjoy the moment. Father McCabe waited patiently, and so did everyone else. When he had his jersey arranged just so, he pulled it over his head, then tugged here and there until it was properly in place. It strained over the biceps and was very tight across the chest and around the neck, but every other Spartan there would have killed to feel it so well. It was loose at the narrow waist, and when he carefully tucked it into his pants, the jersey looked as if it might burst open. He hugged his mother again. Someone applauded, then several people stood, clapping. "Welcome home, Jesse. We still love you." Quickly, the bleachers rattled as people rose to their feet. A thunderous wave of applause engulfed Rake Field as the town embraced a fallen hero. Jesse nodded, then waved awkwardly as he continued his slow walk to the podium. The standing ovation grew louder as he shook hands with Father McCabe and hugged Miss Lila. He hugged his way through a haphazard aisle of former players and finally found an empty folding chair that seemed to sink under his weight. By the time Jesse was seated and still, tears were dripping from his face. Father McCabe waited until all was quiet again. There would be no rush on this day. No one was watching the clock. He adjusted the mic again and said, "One of Coach Rake's favorite scripture verses was the 23rd Psalm. We read it together last Monday. His favorite lines were, 'Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me.'" Eddie Rake lived his life with no fear. His players were taught that those who were timid and frightened have no place among the victors. Those who take no risks receive no rewards. A few months ago, Coach Rake accepted the reality that his death was inevitable. He was unafraid of his disease and the suffering that would follow. He was unafraid of saying goodbye to those he loved. He was unafraid of dying. His faith in God was strong and unshakable. "Death is just the beginning," he liked to say. Father McCabe bowed slightly and backed away from the podium. On cue, an all-female choir from a black church began humming. They wore scarlet and gold robes and, after a short warm-up, launched into a boisterous rendition of Amazing Grace. The music stirred emotions, as it always does on such occasions, and memories. Every Spartan player was soon lost in his own images of Eddie Rake. For Neely, thoughts of Rake always began with a slap in the face, the broken nose, the punch that knocked out his coach, and the dramatic comeback for the state title. And he always fought himself to move on, to get past that painful moment, and recapture the good times. Rare is the coach who can motivate players to spend their lives seeking his approval. From the time Neely first put on a uniform in the sixth grade, he wanted Rake's attention. And for the next 6 years, with every pass he threw, every drill he ran, every play he memorized, every weight he lifted, every hour he spent sweating, every pregame speech he gave, every touchdown he scored, every game he won, every temptation he resisted, every honor roll he made, he coveted Eddie Rake's approval. He wanted to see Rake's face when he won the Heisman. He dreamed of Rake's phone call when Tech won the national title. And rare is the coach who compounds every failure long after the playing days are over. When the doctors told Neely he would never play again, he felt as if he had fallen short of Rake's ambition for him. When his marriage dissolved, he could almost see Rake's disapproving scowl. As his small-time real estate career drifted with no clear ambition, he knew Rake would have a lecture if he got close enough to hear it. Maybe his death would kill the demon that dogged him, but he had his doubts. Ellen Rake Young, the eldest daughter, walked to the podium when the choir was finished and unfolded a sheet of paper. Like her sisters, she had wisely fled Messina after high school and returned only when family matters required. Her father's shadow was too mammoth for his children to survive in such a small place. She was in her mid-40s, a psychiatrist in Boston, and had the air of someone who was out of place. She began, "On behalf of our family, I thank you for your prayers and support during these last weeks. My father died with a great deal of courage and dignity. Though his last years here were not some of his best, he loved this town and its people, and he especially loved his players." Love was not a word any of the players had ever heard their coach use. If he'd loved them, he'd had a strange way of showing it. She continued, "My father has written a short note that he asked me to read." She adjusted her reading glasses, cleared her throat, and focused on the sheet of paper. "This is Eddie Rake, speaking from the grave. If you are crying, please stop." This brought scattered laughter from the crowd, which was anxious for a light moment. "I've never had any use for tears. My life is now complete, so don't cry for me. And don't cry for the memories. Never look back, There's too much left to do. I'm a lucky man who lived a wonderful life. I had the good sense to marry Lila as soon as I could talk her into it. And God blessed us with three beautiful daughters, and at last count, 8 perfect grandchildren. This alone is enough for any man. But God had many blessings in store for me. He led me to football and to Messina, my home. And there I met you, my friends, and my players. Though I was emotionally unable to convey my feelings, I want my players to know that I cherished every one of them. Why would any sane person coach high school football for 34 years? For me, it was easy. I love my players. I wish I had been able to say so, but it was simply not my nature. We accomplished much, but I will not dwell on the victories and the championships. Instead, I choose this moment to offer 2 regrets. Ellen paused here and cleared her throat again. The crowd appeared to hold its collective breath. Only 2 regrets in 34 years. As I said, I'm a lucky man. The first is Scotty Reardon. I never dreamed I would be responsible for the death of one of my players, but I accept the blame for his death. Holding him in my arms as he passed away is something I have wept over every day since. I have expressed these feelings to his parents, and, with time, I think they have forgiven me. I cling to their forgiveness and take it to my death. I am with Scotty now and for eternity, and as we look down together at this moment, we have reconciled our past. Another pause as Ellen took a sip of water. The second involves the state title game in 1987. At halftime, in a fit of rage, I physically assaulted a player, our quarterback. It was a criminal act, one that should have banned me from the game forever. I am sorry for my actions. As I watched that team rally against enormous odds, I have never felt such pride and such pain. That victory was my finest hour. Please forgive me, boys. Neely glanced around him. All heads were low. Most eyes were closed. Silo was wiping his face. Enough of the negative. My love to Lila and the girls and the grandkids. We'll all meet very soon across the river in the promised land. May God be with you. The choir sang, "Just a closer walk with thee," and the tears were flowing. Neely couldn't help but wonder if Cameron was keeping her emotions in check. He suspected that she was. Rake had asked 3 of his former players to deliver eulogies, short ones he had demanded in writing from his deathbed. The first was given by the Honorable Mike Hilliard, now a circuit court judge in a small town 100 miles away. Unlike most of the former Spartans, he wore a suit, one with wrinkles, and a crooked bow tie. He grabbed the podium with both hands and didn't need notes. "I played on Coach Rake's first team in 1958, he began in a squeaky voice with a thick drawl. "The year before, we won 3 games and lost 7, which back then was considered a good season because we beat Porterville in our final game. The coach left town, took his assistants with him, and for a while we weren't sure we'd find anyone to coach us. They hired this young guy named Eddie Rake, who wasn't much older than we were. The first thing he told us that we were a bunch of losers, that losing is contagious, that if we thought we could lose with him, then we could hit the door. 41 of us signed up for football that year. Coach Rake took us off to an old church camp over in Page County for August drills, and after 4 days, the squad was down to 30. After a week, we were down to 25, and some of us were beginning to wonder if we'd survive long enough to field a team. The practices were beyond brutal. The bus from Messina left every afternoon, and we were free to get on it. After 2 weeks, the bus was empty, and it stopped running. The boys who quit came home telling horror stories of what was happening at Camp Rake, as it was soon called. Our parents were alarmed. My mother told me later she felt like I was off at war. Unfortunately, I've seen war, and I would prefer it over Camp Rake. We broke camp with 21 players. 21 kids who'd never been in such great shape. We were small and slow and didn't have a quarterback, but we were convinced. Our first game was at home against Fulton, a team that had embarrassed us the year before. I'm sure some of y'all remember it. We led 20-0 at halftime, and Ray cussed us because we'd made some mistakes. His genius was simple. Stick to the basics and work nonstop until you can execute them perfectly. Lessons I have never forgotten. We won that game, and we were celebrating the locker room when Rake walked in, told us to shut up. Evidently, our execution had not been perfect. He told us to keep the gear on. And after the crowd left, we came back to this field and practiced until midnight. We ran two plays until all 11 guys got everything perfect. Our girlfriends were waiting. Our parents were waiting. It was nice to win the game. But folks were beginning to think Coach Rake was crazy. The players already knew it. We won 8 games that year, lost only 2, and the legend of Eddie Rake was born. My senior year, we lost 1 game. Then in 1960, Coach Rake had his first undefeated season. I was away at college and couldn't get home every Friday, though I desperately wanted to. When you play for Rake, you join an exclusive little club, and you follow the teams that come behind you. For the next 32 years, I followed Spartan football as closely as possible. I was here, sitting up there in the bleachers, when the great streak began in 64, and I was at South Wayne when it ended in 1970. Along with y'all, I watched the great ones play. Wally Webb, Roman Armstead, Jesse Trapp, Neely Crenshaw. On the walls of my cluttered office hang the photos of all 34 of Rake's teams. He would send me a picture of the team every year. Often when I should be working, I'll light my pipe and stand before them and look at the faces of all the young men he coached. Skinny white boys in the 1950s with crew cuts and innocent smiles. Shaggier ones in the 1960s, fewer smiles, determined looks. You can almost see the ominous clouds of war and civil rights in their faces. Black and white players smiling together in the 70s and 80s, much bigger kids, with fancier uniforms. Some were the sons of boys I played with. I know that every player looking down from my walls was indelibly touched by Eddie Rake. They ran the same plays, heard the same pep talks, got the same lectures, endured the same brutal drills in August. And every one of us at some time became convinced that we truly hated Eddie Rake. Then we were gone. Our pictures hang on the walls, and we spend the rest of our lives hearing the sound of his voice in the locker room, longing for the days when we called him Coach. Most of those faces are here today, slightly older, grayer, some a bit heavier, all sadder as we say goodbye to Coach Rake. And why do we care? Why are we here? Why are the stands once again filled and overflowing? Well, I will tell you why. Few of us will ever do anything that will be recognized and remembered by more than a handful of people. We are not great. We may be good, honest, fair, hardworking, loyal, kind, generous, and very decent, or we may be otherwise, but we are not considered great. Greatness comes along so rarely that when we see it, we want to touch it. Eddie Rake allowed us, players and fans, to touch greatness, to be a part of it. He was a great coach who built a great program and a great tradition and gave us all something great, something we will always cherish. Hopefully, most of us will live long, happy lives, but we will never again be this close to greatness. That's why we're here. Whether you loved Eddie Rake or you didn't, You cannot deny his greatness. He was the finest man I've ever met. My happiest memories are of wearing the green jersey and playing for him on this field. I long for those days. I can hear his voice, feel his wrath, smell his sweat, see his pride. I will always miss the great Eddie Rake. He paused, then bowed and abruptly backed away from the microphone as a light, almost awkward applause crept through the crowd. As soon as he sat down, a thick-chested black gentleman in a gray suit stood and marched with great dignity to the podium. Under his jacket was a green jersey. He looked up and gazed upon the crowd packed tightly together. "Good afternoon," he announced with a voice that needed no microphone. "I'm Reverend Collis Suggs of the Bethel Church of God in Christ, here in Messina." Collis Suggs needed no introduction to anyone who lived within 50 miles of Messina. Eddie Rake had appointed him as the first black captain in 1970. He played briefly at Florida A&M before breaking a leg, then became a minister. He built a large congregation and became involved politically. For years it had been said that if Eddie Rake and Collis Suggs wanted you elected, then you got elected. If not, then take your name off the ballot. 30 years in the pulpit had honed his speaking skills to perfection. His diction was perfect. His timing and pitch were captivating. Coach Rake was known to sneak into the rear pew of the Bethel Church on Sunday nights just to hear his former nose guard preach. "I played for Coach Rake in 69 and 70. Most of those in the crowd had seen every game. In late July 1969, the U.S. Supreme Court had finally had enough. 15 years after Brown versus Board of Education, and most schools in the South were still segregated. The court took drastic action, and it changed our lives forever. One hot summer night, we were playing basketball in the gym at Section High, the colored school, when Coach Thomas walked in and said, 'Boys, we're going to Messina High School. You're going to be Spartans. Get on the bus.' About a dozen of us loaded on the bus, and Coach Thomas drove us across town. We were confused and scared. We had been told many times that the schools would be integrated, but deadlines had come and gone. We knew Messina High had the finest of everything. Beautiful buildings, nice fields, a huge gym, lots of trophies, a football team that had won, at that time, something like 50 or 60 straight. And they had a coach who thought he was Vince Lombardi. Yes, we were intimidated, but we knew we had to be brave. We arrived at Messina High that night. The football team was lifting weights in this huge weight room. More weights than I'd ever seen in my life. About 40 guys, pumping iron, sweating, music going. As soon as we walked in, everything was quiet. They looked at us. We looked at them. Eddie Rake walked over, shook hands with Coach Thomas, and said, 'Welcome to your new school.' He made us all shake hands. Then he set us down on the mats and gave us a little speech. He said he didn't care what color we were. All his players wore green. His playing field was perfectly level. Hard work won games. He didn't believe in losing. I remember sitting there on that rubber mat, mesmerized by this man. He immediately became my coach. Eddie Rake was many things, but he was the greatest motivator I've ever met. I wanted to put on the pads and start hitting people right then. 2 weeks later, we started two-a-day practices in August, and I have never hurt so much in my life. Rake was right. Skin color didn't matter. He treated us all like dogs, equally. There was a lot of concern about the first day of classes, about fights and racial conflict. And most schools saw a lot of it. Not here. The principal put Coach Rake in charge of security, and everything went smoothly. He put all of his players in green game jerseys. same ones we're wearing right now. And he paired us up, a black player with a white player. When the buses rolled in, we were there to greet them. The first thing the black kid saw at Messina High was the football team. Black and white players together. Everybody wearing green. A couple of hotheads wanted some trouble, but we convinced them otherwise. The first controversy was over the cheerleaders. The white girls had been practicing all summer as a squad. Coach Rake went to the principal and said half and half would work just fine. And it did. Still does. Next came the band. There wasn't enough money to combine the white band and the black band and have everybody march in Messina uniforms. Some kids would get cut. It looked like most of those left on the sideline would be black. Coach Rake went to the booster club, said he needed $20,000 for new band uniforms, said Messina would have the largest high school marching band in the state. And we still do. There was a lot of resistance to integration. Many white folks thought it was only temporary. Once the courts got finished, then everything would revert back to the old system of separate but equal. I'm here to tell you, separate was never equal. There was a lot of speculation on our side of town about whether the white coaches would actually play black kids. And there was a lot of pressure from the white side of town to play white kids only. After 3 weeks of practice with Eddie Rake, we knew the truth. Our first game that year was against North Delta. They hit the field all white. Had about 15 black guys on the bench. I knew some of them, knew they could play. Rake put the best players on the field, and we soon realized that North Delta did not. It was a slaughter. At halftime, we were leading 41-0. When the second half started, the black kids came off the bench for North Delta, and I have to admit, we relaxed a little. Problem was, nobody relaxed with Eddie Rake. If he caught you loafing on the field, then you got to stay on the sideline with him. Word spread that Messina was starting their black kids, and soon the issue was settled all over the state. Eddie Rake was the first white man who ever yelled at me and made me like it. Once I realized that he truly did not care about the color of my skin, then I knew I would follow him anywhere. He hated injustice. Because he was not from here, he brought a different perspective. No person had the right to mistreat another, and if Coach Rake got wind of it, then there was a fight coming. For all of his toughness, he was terribly sensitive to the suffering of others. After I became a minister, Coach Rake would come to our church and work in our outreach programs. He opened his home to abandoned and abused children. He never made much money as a coach, but he was generous when someone needed food or clothing or even tuition. He coached youth teams in the summer. Of course, knowing Rake, he was also looking for boys who could run. He organized fishing rodeos for kids with no fathers. Typically, he never sought recognition for any of this. The Reverend took a pause and a sip of water. The crowd watched every move and waited. After they fired Coach Rake, I spent some time with him. He was convinced that he had been treated unfairly. But as the years went by, I think Coach accepted his fate. I know he grieved over Scotty Reardon. And I'm so happy that he was laid to rest this morning next to Scotty. Maybe now this town can stop the feuding. How ironic that the man who put us on the map, the man who did so much to bring us together, was also the man that Messina has been fighting over for 10 years now. Let's all bury the hatchet, lay down our arms, and make peace over Eddie Rake. We are all one in Christ, and in this wonderful little town, we are one in Eddie Rake. God bless our coach. God bless you. The string quartet played a mournful ballad that went on for 10 minutes. Leave it to Rake to have the final word. Leave it to Rake to manipulate his players one last time. Neely certainly couldn't say anything bad about his coach, not at this moment. From the grave, Rake had apologized. Now he wanted Neely to stand before the town accept the apology, then add a few warm words of his own. His first reaction upon receiving a note from Miss Lila that a eulogy was requested was to curse and ask, "Why me?" Of all the players Ray coached, dozens were certainly closer to him than Neely. Paul suspected it was Rake's way of making a final peace with Neely and the 87 team. Whatever the reason, there was no proper way to decline a eulogy. Paul said it simply could not be done. Neely said he had never done one before, had never spoken in front of a large group, or a small one either, for that matter, and furthermore, was considering an escape in the middle of the night to avoid the entire matter. As he walked slowly among the players, his feet were heavy, his left knee aching more than usual. Without a limp, he stepped into the small platform and situated himself behind the podium. Then he looked at the crowd, all staring down at him, and he almost fainted. Between the 20-yard lines, 60 yards total, and up 50 rows, the home side of Rake Field was nothing but a wall of faces peering down to admire an old hero. Without a fight, he succumbed completely to fear. He'd been afraid and nervous all morning. Now he was terrified. Slowly, he unfolded a sheet of paper and took his time trying to read the words he'd written and rewritten. "Ignore the crowd," he told himself. "You cannot embarrass yourself. These people remember a great quarterback, not a coward whose voice is cracking." "I'm Neely Crenshaw," he managed to say with some certainty. He found a spot on the chain-link fence along the track, directly in front of him, just over the heads of the players, and just under the first row of the bleachers. He would direct his comments to that part of the fence and ignore everything else. Hearing his voice over the public address calmed him a little. He continued, "And I played for Coach Rake from 84 to 87. He looked at his notes again and remembered a lecture from Rake. "Fear is inevitable, and it is not always bad. Harness your fear and use it to your advantage." Of course, to Rake, that meant sprinting from the locker room onto the field and trying to cripple the first opposing player in sight. Hardly good advice when eloquent words were needed. Staring at the fence, Neely shrugged and tried to smile and said, "Look, I'm not a judge, and I'm not a minister, and I'm not accustomed to speaking before groups, so please be patient with me." The adoring crowd would allow him anything. Fumbling with his notes, he began to read. "The last time I saw Coach Rake was in 1989. I was in the hospital a few days after surgery, and he sneaked into my room late one night. A nurse came in and told him that he had to leave. Visiting hours were over. He explained very clearly that he would leave when he got ready, and not one minute before. She left in a huff." Neely glanced up and looked at the players. Lots of smiles. His voice was solid, no cracks. He was surviving. "I had not spoken to Coach Rake since the 87 championship game. Now I guess everybody knows why. What happened then was a secret that we all buried. We didn't forget it, because that would have been impossible. So we just kept it to ourselves. That night in the hospital, I looked up and there was Coach Rake, standing beside my bed, wanting to talk. After a few awkward moments, we began to gossip. He pulled a chair close and we talked for a long time. We talked as we never talked before. Old games, old players, lots of memories of Messina football. We had a few laughs. He wanted to know about my injury. When I told him the doctors were almost certain that I would never play again, his eyes watered and he couldn't speak for a long time. A promising career was suddenly over, and Rake asked me what I planned to do. I was 19 years old. I had no idea. He made me promise that I would finish college, a promise that I failed to keep. He finally got around to the championship game, and he apologized for his actions. He made me promise that I would forgive him. Another promise I failed to keep, until now. At some point, without realizing it, Neely's eyes had drifted away from his notes and away from the chain-link fence. He was looking at the crowd. When I could walk again, I found that going to class took too much effort. I went to college to play football, and when that was suddenly over, I lost interest in studying. After a couple of semesters, I dropped out and drifted for a few years, trying to forget about Messina and Eddie Rake and all the broken dreams. Football was a dirty word. I allowed the bitterness to fester and grow, and I was determined never to come back. With time, I tried my best to forget about Eddie Rake. A couple of months ago, I heard that he was very ill and probably would not survive. 14 years had passed since I last set foot on this field, the night Coach Rake retired my number. Like all the former players here today, I felt the irresistible call to come home, to come back to this field where we once owned the world. Regardless of my feelings about Coach Rake, I knew I had to be here when he died. I had to say farewell, and I had to finally and sincerely accept his apology. I should have done it earlier. The last few words were strained. Neely gripped the podium and paused as he looked at Paul and Silo, both nodding, both saying, "Get on with it." Once you've played for Eddie Rake, you carry him with you forever. You hear his voice, you see his face. You long for his smile of approval. You remember his tongue lashings and his lectures. With each success in life, you want Rake to know about it. You want to say, "Hey, Coach, look at what I've done." And you want to thank him for teaching you that success is not an accident. And with each failure, you want to apologize because he did not teach us to fail. He refused to accept failure. You want his advice on how to overcome it. At times you get tired of carrying Coach Rake around. You want to be able to screw up and not hear him bark. You want to slide and maybe cut a corner without hearing his whistle. Then the voice will tell you to pick yourself up, to set a goal, to work harder than anybody else, stick to the basics, execute perfectly, be confident, be brave, and never, never quit. The voice is never far away. We will leave here today without the physical presence of our coach, but his spirit will live in the hearts and minds and souls of all the young boys he touched, all the kids who became men under Eddie Rake. His spirit will move us and motivate us and comfort us for the rest of our lives, I guess. 15 years later, I think about Coach Rake more than ever. There's a question I've asked myself 1,000 times, and I know that every player has struggled with it too. The question is, do I love Eddie Rake, or do I hate him? The voice began to crack and fade. Neely closed his eyes, bit his tongue, and tried to summon the strength to finish. Then he wiped his face and said slowly, "I've answered the question differently every day since the first time he blew his whistle and barked at me. Coach Rake was not easy to love, and while you're playing here, you really don't like him. But after you leave, after you venture away from this place, after you've been kicked around a few times, faced some adversity, some failure, been knocked down by life, you soon realize how important Coach Rake is and was. You always hear his voice, urging you to pick yourself up, to do better, and never quit. You miss that voice. Once you're away from Coach Rake, you miss him so much." He was straining now. "Either sit down or embarrass yourself." He glanced at Silo, who clenched a fist as if to say, "Finish it and fast." "I've loved 5 people in my life," Neely said, looking up bravely at the crowd. His voice was fading, so he gritted his teeth and pushed on. "My parents, a certain girl who's here today, my ex-wife, and Eddie Rake." He struggled for a long, painful pause, then said, "I'll sit down now." When Father McCabe finished the benediction and dismissed the crowd, there was little movement. The town was not ready to say goodbye to its coach. As the players stood and gathered around Miss Lyle and the family, the town watched from the stands. The choir sang a soft spiritual, and a few folks began drifting toward the front gate. Every player wanted to say something to Jesse Trapp, as if chatting him up might delay his inevitable return to prison. After an hour, Rabbit cranked up the John Deere mower and began cutting the south end zone. There was, after all, a game to be played. Kickoff against Hermantown was 5 hours away. When Miss Lyle and the family began moving away from the tent, the players followed slowly behind. Workers quickly disassembled the tent and removed the tarp and folding chairs. The home benches were arranged in a straight line. The field paint crew, a highly experienced squad of boosters, began scurrying around, already behind schedule. They worshipped rake, but the field had to be striped, and the midfield logo touched up. The cheerleaders arrived and began working furiously to hang hand-painted banners along the fence around the field. They tinkered with a fog machine to enhance the team's dramatic entry through the end zone. They looped hundreds of balloons around the goalposts. Rake was only a legend to them. At the moment, they had far more serious matters to think about. The band could be heard in the distance on one of the practice fields, tuning up, practicing maneuvers. Football was in the air. Friday night was rapidly approaching. At the front gate, the former players shook hands and hugged and made the usual promises to get together more often. Some took quick photos of the remnants of old teams. More hugs, more promises, more long, sad looks at the field where they once played under the great Eddie Rake. Finally, they left. The 87 team met at Silo's cabin a few miles out of town. It was an old hunting lodge deep in the woods on the edge of a small lake. Silo had put some money into it. There was a pool, three decks on different levels for serious lounging, and a new pier that ran 50 feet into the water where it stopped at a small boathouse. Two of his employees, no doubt master car thieves, were grilling steaks on a lower deck. Nat Sawyer brought a box of smuggled cigars. Two kegs of beer were on ice. They drifted to the boathouse, where Silo, Neely, and Paul were sitting in folding lawn chairs, swapping insults, telling jokes, chatting away about everything but football. The kegs were hit hard. The jokes became raunchier, the laughter much louder. The steaks were served around 6. The initial plan was to watch the Spartans play that night, but not a word was said about leaving the cabin. By kickoff, most were unable to drive. Silo was drunk and headed for a very bad hangover. Neely had one beer, then switched to soft drinks. He was tired of Messina and all the memories. It was time to leave the town and return to the real world. When he began saying goodbye, they begged him to stay. Silo almost cried as he hugged him. Neely promised he would return in 1 year to that very cabin where they would celebrate the first anniversary of Rake's death. He drove Paul home and left him in the driveway. "Are you serious about coming back next year?" Paul asked. "Sure, I'll be here." "Is that a promise?" "Yes." "You don't keep promises." "I'll keep this one, Paul." He drove past the lanes and did not see the rental car. Cameron was probably home by now, a million miles from Messina. She might think of him once or twice in the coming days, but the thoughts would not linger. He drove past the home where he'd lived for 10 years, past the park where he'd played youth baseball and football. The streets were empty because everyone was at Rake Field. At the cemetery, he waited until another aging ex-Spartan finished his meditation in the dark. When the figure finally stood and walked away, Neely crept through the stillness. He squatted low next to Scotty Reardon's headstone and touched the fresh dirt of Rake's grave. He said a prayer, had a tear, and spent a long moment saying goodbye. He drove around the empty square, then through the back streets until he found the gravel trail. He parked on Carr's Hill and for an hour sat on the hood, watching and listening to the game in the distance. Late in the third quarter, he called it quits. The past was finally gone now. It left with Rake. Neely was tired of the memories and broken dreams. Give it up, he told himself. You'll never be the hero again. Those days are gone now. Driving away, he vowed to return more often. Messina was the only hometown he knew. The best years of his life were there. He'd come back and watch the Spartans on Friday night, sit with Paul and Mona and all their children, party with Silo and Hubcap, eat at Renfro's, drink coffee with Nat Sawyer. And when the name of Eddie Rake was mentioned, he would smile and maybe laugh and tell a story of his own, one with a happy ending. This is John Grisham. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Bleachers. This program was produced and directed by John McElroy, executive producer Dan Zitt, and special appearance by Jack Crystal. Text copyright 2003 by John Grisham. Production copyright 2003, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.